Thanks for downloading this podcast from the Lancaster Health Festival. For details of others and more information about the festival and the lost art of living, check out the website thelancasterhealthfestival.org.uk and spread the word.
Currently stood on a modern housing estate built in 2002, an extension to Freehold in Lancaster. Not the kind of place you'd expect to be growing medicine, but I have with me Jennifer Lorawal, who has done exactly that. We're outside a house now and a patch of ground. Jennifer, tell us all about it.
Well, this patch of ground was originally part of just the general landscaping for the estate, and one of the neighbours had taken out all the bushes, so it was just scrappy land, really, basically. And I asked if I could plant it up, and so the first thing I planted was the edible hedge. So if you'd like to come with me, I'll show you. And you can see there are butterflies right now on some of the buddleia.
So when you say edible, can I eat this?
You can. Look. Let's see how many plants we can find here. Do you recognise this one?
It looks like a chunk of rhubarb to me.
Yeah, that's rhubarb.
Excellent. We like rhubarb. Yeah, there's strawberries down here.
That's right. Okay. Now, my guess is you might not recognise this.
It looks a bit like a damson, I don't know.
Well, that's very close. It's an Amelanchier lamarckii, otherwise known as a Juneberry.
I'll take a Juneberry because I couldn't say the first one after
yeah,
a drink.
Yeah, Juneberry, and it's got lovely flowers in the springtime. The leaves turn red in autumn, and it's got delicious berries on it as well. So it's one of those edible ornamental plants that
I guess the interesting thing about all this is with the edible hedges. You think of a hedge, people think of,
Hawthorn
at best, you know, otherwise a bit of a privet hedge or something like that. But what you're saying is you can create hedges out of all sorts of plants and make them much more attractive and much more
Absolutely.
Useful.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I got this idea from the Millennium Orchard. Okay. And around the Millennium Oak, they have an edible hedge. And so I can't take this idea, I can't say that it was my idea, but my particular way of planting.
Have some glory, because you made the hedge, it looks
right.
Great.
So as we're looking up on the butterflies up on the buddleia, All these buddleias came from cracks in the pavement down in the vacant, the vacant lot across from the Duke's.
Actually, I'm with you on that one, because I've got one on my allotment exactly the same. I pinched it out of the back alley from my house.
Exactly. So let's walk along and you'll see. And so on this side, there are lots of edible wild plants growing in here as well. Some of them are for the bees. And I also want to say this is an educational hedge because the children in the neighbourhood over the years, we've done activities together. And one of the activities that I taught the children was how to propagate plants. So this beautiful rose here, which is a bee plant, was propagated by one of the lads who lives in our estate. He's at university now, but he liked it and he propagated from his mum's garden after I taught him how to propagate. So this is also a whole history of education for the children who've lived here over the last 14 years.
I'm tempted to ask for a cutting myself. It's a fantastic looking plant.
It is,
it?
And it goes on all year, and because you can always tell when a rose is good for bees because it's still got the stamens in the centre and it opens up completely.
Yeah.
So if you're choosing a rose and you also want it to be good for wildlife, That's a way to choose. But working our way down, we have here an apple, for instance. Although it looks like the apples have disappeared. I'm sorry about that, but we have another one further on.
Okay, let's walk down here.
If we carry on, so underneath there are wild plants coming in which are also edible. Here we have self-heal, which elsewhere in the garden still has purple flowers. That's also edible and medicinal.
Okay. What's the medicine for self-heal then?
What does it do? It's respiratory, but I think that's the sort of question that you really need
to ask
our colleague here.
Okay, you're right.
And as you can see, this is at a rather wild stage of the proceedings of the year. And the reason is because I have on the outside here 5 raised beds in which I have sown wild meadow seed. And the reason, it's all about wildlife. Now, I have in here, for example, hollyhocks for next year. And hollyhocks are kind of mallow. And mallow is edible, and it's also a medicinal plant. And if we sort of wend our way outward and through the meadow...
I feel like I'm in a BBC Radio 4 nature programme.
That's fantastic. Can you see raspberries coming through?
Yes, I can, yeah.
Gooseberries walking along... apples.
Oh, they're there, that's apples. Right, you've got some apples to crop. Yeah.
And I do, and I've got a wild blackberry that I've trained through the apple tree.
Fantastic.
So that's all edible. And then as we move along...
So blackberry and apple pie is no problem in your house.
Exactly. I'm just waiting for the apples
to ripen. We'll have people booking in. It's just
I hope so. Well, I do, because I have done Airbnb for many years. And we have your squash plants that I've planted in between. And coming down then further, this is evening primrose, which is edible. The entire plant is edible and a medicinal. Again, for women.
Right. Now, if you'd have said flowers, I've seen flowers in trendy kind of cafes and restaurants like with your salad, but I'd have believed that. But the whole plant, so the stem itself is edible.
Everything, and particularly the root, which is high in carbohydrates.
Okay.
So if you had to be foraging for your food because of food security issues, then you could actually eat the roots of that. And
what
you'd
does it
get
taste
them.
Like?
Bitter.
Basically,
learning to eat wild food is a matter of widening your taste buds so that you can cope with bitter, basically, or sour.
I have heard that criticism before, that arctic butterflies over there, that actually one of the problems we have in modern Western culture is we stop eating bitter food, and there's certain ailments kind of come from that.
That's good. And they're always, they also stimulate the liver and the bile duct,
which
helps to digest fat and so on. And again, my colleague can tell you more
fantastic.
About that.
Yeah.
But just coming down here so you can see, this is more the edible bit. This is a berry, which you probably also won't have on your allotment.
Yeah.
This is called Aronia.
Okay.
Aronia melanocarpa, otherwise known as chokeberry.
That doesn't sound very enticing.
Well, try one.
Can I try one? Okay.
Yeah, now they're quite astringent, actually.
Okay.
But they make absolutely fabulous jam.
Wow.
And in the Eastern European countries, they use it to make syrup. Similar to our Ribena.
I can see why. It's a very dry taste, isn't
it? That's right.
So,
that's the astringency. Yeah, absolutely. And it's that also very, very
but
high.
But it's not unpleasant. I mean, it's not overly sweet, but it's,
yeah.
it's, you know.
You could have it on your cereal with a bit of sugar,
yes, you
actually.
Could, yeah.
I mean, I've already harvested them for this year and shared them with the neighbourhood, because that's another thing that we're doing here, is we're sharing it. It's another one of those plants that will grow anywhere. It's really pretty, and in the autumn it turns red. It's gorgeous.
So how tall would this plant grow?
Let's think of
our listener for a minute. I mean, could they put this in their back garden, and would it get
it depends on the size of their garden.
Yeah.
I mean, if they had a small place, they could put it in a large container, actually,
right,
and it
so
would
it
still
could
grow.
Pot, be pot grown.
Or,
yeah.
It could be pot grown. Or they could plant it in the centre of their front lawn as a small tree, actually. Or they could keep it smaller, like a hedge plant. So it's all
sorts of options for them.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, this edible hedge is meant to imitate a woodland edge habitat. However, with all edible plants for humans.
Right.
So it's copying nature's patterns. This pattern of a multi-layered edge. But in ways which are also beneficial for humans as well as for wildlife. That's the idea. So anyway, just going down, you can see, so there's lots of other things that you'll recognise. There's more squash plants. There's calendula, which is one of the edible flowers.
That's
and
right,
it's highly
yeah,
medicinal
yeah.
as well. And it itself seeds and so on and so forth. And then looking over here, so we've got the five beds of the meadow. And there's a lot of edible in here. Here we have salad burnet, for example, which has come up. This is one of the dock family. That's edible as well. I mean,
what's striking about this is this is not big, is it? It's a really small, narrow bed. It just shows what you can do in an incredibly small space.
Exactly. And if you were sitting here with your coffee, looking, when the sun is on it, you'd see lots and lots of activity here. Of all kinds of creatures, and underfoot too. You'll notice, even though our listeners can't see that I've allowed the lawn in inverted commas.
This is not going to win a prize lawn competition, but it does look fantastic.
No, but it depends, because we have to change the criteria.
Of course we
too.
Do. Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
You can see there's raspberries coming up here.
Yeah.
But there's lots of clover, and which is also edible and medicinal for women. What's it called? Plantain.
Which
is edible,
right,
but
yeah,
it's all edible and medicinal, and so on. So even the lawn bit can be allowed to be a bit longer, and then there's lots of creatures that will benefit from that, really.
Go to your head, Jennifer, and we're back now in your driveway. There's four of us sat around a recycling bin, really. That sounds good, doesn't it? But we're now being joined by Julia Russell. And Julia, first of all, who are you?
I'm a local practicing herbalist here in Lancaster. I've practiced for over 25 years. I see a lot of clients in the area, but I'm also interested in foraging and I'm originally trained in horticulture as well, so I'm interested in growing.
Fantastic. So I'm intrigued by that. So I'm going to test your knowledge first. I'm going to ask Jennifer now to name a couple of plants that we've seen in the hedge, and I want you to describe them to me and how traditionally they might have been used for medicine. Is that okay? Jennifer, give me a couple of plants.
Well, there's so many in the hedge. The first one that comes to mind is dandelion.
Dandelion, the common dandelion. We did get out of our lawns. Tell me all about it.
Okay, yeah. It's, you know, most people would consider it a weed, but actually every bit of it is medicinal. Or edible, in fact. So I use the roots for making dandelion coffee, but I also use them to help move the bile in the body, get the liver moving better. And then the leaves, you know, we know the French is pissenlit. Jennifer will correct my French. Yeah. She speaks French, but which means wet the bed, because it's a diuretic herb. So it really moves the waters in the body and gets the urine flowing. And then the flower petals, you know, the way it grows, the yellow petals, which are, you can actually make into like a honey syrup. Well, they call it honey, but it's a syrup. Which you can put on toast. Do you know what I mean?
I am fascinated. I remember my grandparents saying to me when I was playing as a wee boy that whatever you do, don't eat dandelions, you'll wet the bed. So yeah, obviously yeah. That kind of tradition is still there.
Is.
Fantastic. Jennifer, give us another one that we'll go on to
broadleaf plantain.
Oh, yeah, plantain. So that's a fantastic first aid in the field, I would call that. So if you get stung by a nettle, I would go for plantain rather than dock, always. You can just chew it up, rub it on the stings, and it will take down all those lumps and bumps you've just got from the nettle stings. Also for bites, it's one of the things I primarily would use for horsefly bites, which I had recently all up my arm, and that's what I poulticed on, actually external treatment. But you can drink it as well as a tea. It helps to purify and clean the blood out. So yeah, plantain, but it's you know, always, if I'm out and about, I was looking for that one. There's broadleaf plantain and there's ribwort, the long skinny one. So at any point in the season you can usually get your hands on some, and it's in the lawns, it's in cracks in the pavement, it's in the side of hedges. So
what about the poor old dock leaf thing? So I've got an affinity with that because as a boy I spent 8 hours rubbing dock leaves on my legs when I'd gone through nettles.
Yeah.
Does it still work?
There's a use for a dock leaf. Yeah. and that is it.
That's all right.
And you can, when they're really young, you can eat them. I wouldn't eat them as they get bigger because they get more bitter as they get bigger, but that's the case of most greens actually. And in herbal medicine, it's really the root we use, which concentrates iron out of the soil. It's very yellow if you dig it, they call it yellow dock in America.
Yeah.
It's very, very yellow, and if you tincture it, that tincture is a deep, dark yellow colour as well. But it's also massively laxative, so you have to be careful. Dosing
people. Okay. I'll skip the docs from now on.
But the interesting thing is that if you took an iron tablet, they actually constipate you. So if you take yellow dock, it'll keep your bowels moving and you're getting the iron from it. It's just I find it difficult to give people because it's so bitter. Most people won't take it. So it ruins a remedy.
And that's interesting because you don't like giving to people. So you treat people. If I turned up with an ailment, what would you do? What's the first thing you'd say to me then as a herbalist?
Well, so I always do a full consultation with anybody. You need to get under the skin of somebody what's going on. It's not just about the physical symptoms. We know that the physical symptoms are the last thing to come. You know, first of all, there's emotional and mental and spiritual disturbance. And then finally, that comes through to the outer layers of the physical levels of the body. So, you know, if someone comes, I don't just want to know what the presenting symptoms are. I want to know what they're eating. I need to know the foundations of their health. Are they exercising? Do they drink any water? How is their sleep? How, you know, with women, what's their menstrual cycle like? So it's a full picture whenever I see somebody. And then you treat that whole person, not just the presenting symptom.
I mean, what I find intriguing about that is there is a move in what is euphemistically called more traditional medicine, but in one sense it's kind of modern medicine, isn't it, at the moment, to move towards personalised care, largely driven by, I think, genetics and identifying people's genetic makeup and pattern and so forth. But interesting that philosophically they're both kind of running along a similar track.
Yeah, well, traditional medicine has always looked at people's constitutional health.
Yeah.
And, you know, recognise that, you know, whether you look at the Galen humours, where they looked at the temperaments and so on in different traditions. It's all very similar.
Yeah, yeah. Galen is back in fashion. I better dust down the Latin for my next.
I'd like to add something there, and then I have another weed which I'd like to mention. You're too, okay. Which is a really important one. Is that all of the things that we've mentioned are also edible, just as food.
Yeah.
So dandelion, I eat dandelion as part of my salads and my greens all year long. It's very high in vitamin C and iron, associated together in a way that is that the body can take. It's higher in vitamin C per 100 grams than oranges are. So if we're in a situation post-Brexit where we have a hard time getting hold of our citrus fruits from Spain, eat our dandelions. But I wanted to say something else, which is that Julie and I have been working together now for 15 years, something like that, a very long time. And I go to Julia when I have health needs as a herbalist, but we always talk about what can I put in the garden so that I can have my own apothecary at home. And also, so I can sit with those plants and simply appreciate the beauty of them. And that is calming. And as we know, in a stressful modern world, simply being less stressed has its own health benefits. So it's a lot more than just something that you have as a tincture. As wonderful as tinctures are, it's about creating an environment for health.
And that's fascinating, because having looked at your back garden, it is just a back garden at one level, isn't it? It's a small space in a modern house that you... turn into a phenomenal area just to sit and to look at, and with a bit of time and creativity. That's fascinating. We'll do one more plant, then I've got another question for you both, which is going to be really interesting. Find a way with that one. Come on.
Stinging nettle.
Stinging nettle. There we go. Wow. We all recognise that one.
Yeah. So again, nettle is one of those that every part of it I would use. So eating them definitely in the spring when they first come through, you pick the tips like you would pick tea. You just pick the top four leaves, maybe six. You get into the habit of being able to pick them without stinging yourself. There's a way to do it. And I will pick bagfuls and then just steam them, and I use them like spinach. So I would make anything from like an omelette with them, or I put them into smoothies, or, you know, because there's no sting in them once you've sort of bashed them down a bit. And I do things like I would put them into pasta sauces, or I make like a nettle-a-loo, like a sargaloo. So I transfer the instead of spinach, I transfer the nettles into that. And then, you know, the roots, that if you've ever tried to dig out nettle roots, they're very stringy.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're very, very stringy and small. So sometimes I did...
I need the garden. You're stressing me out now.
I did once get a sack full of roots brought to me by a client who said, oh, I thought you might make use of these. And they are used in herbal medicine. Again, they have a diuretic quality, and they use... for benign prostate trouble, actually, is what they're mostly used for. And then the seeds right now is nettle seeds. So I've actually got those drying in my clinic. I have an upstairs attic space that I can perfectly dry herbs in, because it gets really warm, but it's shaded. And I've got nettle seeds, and they're useful because they give you lots of energy. So people make them into balls with, they use, you know, nuts and seeds and make like energy balls out of them and add the nettle seeds in. So, you know, it's food rather than medicine that. And that's what Jennifer was saying, I think, really. It's, I personally will try and get people eating right first before I ever give them extra medicine on top, because you can't get people well unless their food is right. And if they can eat from around them, then they're having that connection with the earth and they know where it comes from. And, you know, it's always surprising when people go, oh, I didn't even know I could eat that.
I'm fascinated.
Absolutely. I'm a garden designer, and so I hope that you'll give my Carpe Diem Gardens is my garden design business. But I always design an entirely edible landscape, so that every ornamental garden that I design, all of the plants will be edible. Or if they're not directly edible, they'll be medicinal. Because I want people to learn which of the ornamental plants around us are also edible.
Yeah. And many are without people realising it.
I mean, there is that sense of lost knowledge, isn't there? I mean, that's a crucial thing, I think, really. I mean, the more we've gone down the you buy your food from the supermarket mentality, the less we know about the food we eat, in a sense, or even the supply chain of all that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that moves on to a different question. I mean, why do you do this? I could say, yeah, it's a great hobby, isn't it? I like fishing or something. I don't know. But do you know what I mean? It's just, what is it that drives you to do this? What is it? Who should we go for first? Jenny, are you both looking at each other? I don't know if our listener, our listener obviously can't see, but you are staring at each other, eager to go. Let's go for Jennifer. Come on, Jennifer.
Okay. I have been obsessed, and this is my vocation. This has been my vocation for over 50 years. The growing plants and getting back in touch with nature is an absolute life-giving occupation. I do it, this is how I earn my livelihood, but even if I didn't have to earn my livelihood, it is a passion for the natural world and to help the natural world, which is in crisis now. So that's why I do it. It's not a hobby. It is my entire life, and it has been all of my adult life. So, over to Julie.
The same. I mean, I was about to say, well, it's a vocation, because you end up drawn into it without, you know, I was going down a different path earlier on in my, you know, post-university, and I got drawn into this, and once I was in, I was, like, in the net, and that was it.
So what drew you in?
I think because I enjoyed being outside, because I'd had my own health issues, which I didn't solve via the NHS, I solved them myself with natural remedies. And once I realised that, you know, food was medicine, which was very much a part of that journey, then I was on that track and I couldn't be anywhere else. Do you know what I mean?
So you were hooked.
I was hooked. But I grew up with a gardening grandmother who I spent a lot of time just, you know, digging about in her kitchen. She had a big kitchen garden, and she also was quite a small lady, and she used to take me out because I was quite a tall child to get the things off the top of the hedges, because she was a big winemaker.
Wow. So we've got confessions about child labour now, have we?
Is that what I said? Sorry, I never complained.
I never complained. You loved it. Fantastic. Can I just pick up something you said there? And I think this is worth a wider conversation. You mentioned that you weren't cured by the NHS. I mean, what do you think about the NHS?
I think emergency medicine is very good. I think a lot of treatment is symptomatic, and it doesn't get to the root causes. And that is probably an issue. I like to think that what I do gets more to the root causes.
I'm interested in that, because one of the big conversations in the NHS, and obviously as chaplain part of these conversations, is population health. And just before we started recording, you mentioned something, Jennifer, about that.
I'd like to say two things. First, I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm deeply grateful to the NHS and to Lancaster Royal Infirmary. So that I want to say that. My life was saved by the NHS, so I'm a huge supporter of the NHS. So having said that, I believe that 98% of the illnesses that are treated in the NHS could be prevented or attenuated if people grew healthy food and medicinal gardens. And I'm absolutely convinced of that. And every time I go to the hospital, I am shocked at the terrible physical state of not only the patients, but the staff as well, who are grossly overweight and have all kinds of other things, like they are addicted
I've just
to cigarettes.
I've just taken a look at my midriff, actually. I'm okay, Emma, that's right.
You're obviously well within your healthy BMI, as all of us are. But when you look at both staff and patients, clearly food is one of the most important elephants in the room in terms of the NHS, and how people are not taking hold of their own appetites and making themselves healthy simply by changing their diet. And it is just shocking to me. How can the NHS support that wave of illness based on a Western lifestyle?
I mean, that's an interesting ethical question, isn't it? I mean, are we, in many respects, with our lifestyles, simply supporting the illnesses that we're trying to solve at the same time or cure at the same time? Fascinated by that. Julie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, lifestyle is something I always would look at. If you asked about, you know, if you came to me, what would I do? Yeah. And certainly with every patient...
Send me straight back home, probably.
So. No, with every patient, I'm asking about what is their life like? What are the shifts they work? How can they... You know, can they even eat regular meals? A lot of people come to me and their shift pattern means they eat erratically. They don't get, you know, people get 15-minute lunch break where they can't even digest a meal. No wonder they have digestive problems.
Yeah.
You know, so some of these things, it's always about, okay, within the framework that you're trying to live in, can anything be changed? and can we make your health fit into there? But sometimes people have to look at what they're doing and can they change what they're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to add to that, that formerly, as I came through my middle age, I had put on 3 stone that I didn't need because I had 3 children and I was sedentary and so on. And I went to Slimming World. And Slimming World gave me a way of eating again, which was absolutely healthy. I lost those 3 stone. Now you see that I'm slim and so on. And I believe that that organisations like Slimming World could work really positively with the NHS to address some of the fundamental issues of people's choices and how they eat before
some of this needs to be taught in school. You know, we need to go right back to school and go, you know, what are they feeding kids at school? Do they let children hydrate properly? Do they let children go to the toilet when they need to go? Do you know, there's a whole load of stuff that goes on in school that isn't healthy. And that's the adults that then end up in the hospital later, you know. So I think we need to look at the education system as well there. Mm.
We could talk all day. We don't need 15, 20 minutes. It's non-stop. This is great, actually. But I just want to kind of wrap it up a wee bit, because people can find out more by checking out the Health Festival website and looking at links and so forth, is to ask you both, and we'll start with you, Julie, because you've just given the impassioned speech. if you could change one thing in our culture, if you could change one thing in Lancaster to improve health, what would it be?
Ooh. I think getting people out and walking more and actually getting out in nature. That was the one great thing about lockdown, is that I saw people out walking and looking and spending time. And I think if we could somehow encourage that more within, you know, even all weathers, you know, I know it rains more in Lancaster than a lot of other places, but if you've got the right coat on and you get out and you connect, and connecting with your local area, like you've got your garden here and just connecting with that yourself every day or whatever, but just I do the same routes over and over again and you see it through the seasons.
So Jennifer, it's your turn. What one thing would you change in Lancaster that would make a difference to people's lives?
I would say to everybody, regardless of how much space you have, whether you've got a window ledge or a balcony or a stone yard or a garden, is fill it with plants, particularly herbs. Just fill your space with plants, and the well-being that will derive from that, as well as the food and the medicine, will change your life.
That's fantastic. Jennifer Larrowell, Julie Russell, thank you very much indeed for your time this morning and for arranging to sit out in this pleasant sunshine.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For details of others and more information about the Lancaster Health Festival, go to thelancasterhealthfestival.org.uk.